I'm April Dinwiddie, and you're listening to Cut to the Chase.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Cut to the Chase, episode 43, Passion and Relationships. So as everybody knows, I typically start off our podcast sometimes with a quote. And today's quote basically states, "Your professional is not what you bring home. Your weekly paycheck, your professional is what you put here on earth to do with such passion, such intensity that becomes a spiritual calling." And so, people, today I have a special guest that I tell you, she has been a wonderful lady. She's been a champion. She's been inspiring. And so I'm going to jump right into talking a little bit about her backstory and give her an opportunity to speak. So today, our special guest is a brand communication and marketing professional turned nonprofit leader focused on adoption, foster care, family, identity, and navigating the differences in race, class, and culture. So just think about that for a moment. Just think about that for a second. For someone that is out there promoting all of the things that impact basically the Black community. And so after a successful career in corporate marketing, branding, PR, and a lifetime as a transracial adoptee person, she's devoted to elevating and collecting her experience of family and working together to build strong relationships. She's also a podcaster, born in June, raised in April. What adoption can teach to the world helps facilitate an open dialogue about identity, family, and differences in race, class, and culture. As a marketing strategy at the core, living experience as guide, she develops and facilitates key workshops, offering one-on-one coaching. She's also the former executive of Donaldson Adoption Institute and founder of Adopt Mint, a mentoring program that matches foster youth with adopting adults. She's been a podcaster. She's been a chief executive. She's been an external communicating director. She's been a divisional vice president, an integrated marketing consultant. So today, some of my special guest work includes not only communication consulting for federal grants and supporting adoption education, and regular contributions to the Chronicle of Social Change and Fostering Family Today. But she's also worked with several New York City schools to facilitate adoption support groups for young people and parents, offering the opportunity to facilitate development. So to our listeners, she's passionate, she's experienced, she's interactive with brands, she's committed to integrating across multiple channels and amplification beyond what's going on at this moment in time. And as I wrap up, she's fierce, she's dedicated in developing a healthy identity to build stronger relationships and elevating her collective ability to navigate differences of race, class, and culture. So I'm going to introduce her as April, because I find all of her work and the body of her life work to be quite inspiring. And April, sometimes I don't do a great job of introducing people. What do you have to say?
Oh, you did a fabulous job. Thank you so much for having me and for the space that you make. And this is a great opportunity for me to sort of converge all the things that I have been doing and laboring around for many years. And there aren't many spaces that exist where you can really talk about the totality of our life experiences in such a way. So I appreciate that. And you know, yes, all the things. I'm an adopted person. I'm transracially adopted, which means that I am adopted by parents of a different race than I am. I am biracial and Black. And my family of experience, which would be my adoptive family, are white. So that sort of underpins everything I do, this idea of from the very moment I joined this family, the labor around navigating complicated family structures, differences of race, class, and culture, and identity, you know, sort of underpinned everything I do. And today, that thread through is really kind of present throughout my whole existence, professional and personal, which leads to the passion, right, that I put towards all the work that I do and have done for, you know, many, many, many years.
So as we start to talk about a little bit about the timeline, at what point in your life were you adopted? Was that at a younger age, at a teenage stint, or kind of walk us through that?
Sure. So I first was born, right? We have to be born before we're adopted. And sometimes I think people forget that in the sort of the broader society. We sort of start at chapter two when really we need to start at chapter one, which is being born. I was born to a single mom. Her name was Helen. She had three children already. She was married once already. She was at the time divorced. And again, a single mom of three children, three small children, had very few resources. And the way I understand it is that was very much a crisis pregnancy that she had with me, unplanned, and really did not know what to do. In the notes that the social worker had from the hospital records that I did get, what I wasn't supposed to get, but I did get them, said that she was immobilized by anxiety. So coming into the world, I can only guess, was quite a feat, which is normally so, but on top of just that anxiety and not knowing what she was going to do. So I was in foster care for a bit, maybe 6 months. A family in Rhode Island, my family of experience who adopted me, had wanted another girl. They had two children, two boys, two girls. So two boys and one girl. They wanted two boys and two girls. So they decided that the way to do that would be to adopt. They had no preference for race. They could love any child. They didn't see color, so to speak. And I came into the family as a foster to adopt placement. And then about 2 years later, I was adopted by that family. So it was a short time in foster care. And so from about 7-8 months on, I was part of this Dinwiddie family. And here's where I've remained ever since.
Right. So throughout your time with the Dinwiddie family, as you begin to grow with the family and understanding that their unconditional love and kind of non-bias was kind of wrapped around you because they love you unconditionally. What were some of the things that you encountered early on, being that they were a Caucasian family, you were Black, as you were growing up in life? Explain to me how they kind of reconcile, you know, why they were lighter than you.
Well, you know, quite frankly, they really didn't. I mean, I just want to be very clear. My family is everything to me. My parents are people that are beyond amazing and unique, and they're also very unpracticed in the important art of navigating differences of race, class, and culture. Sure. So what that means is, yes, unconditional love, we love you, we don't see color, all of those things that are well-intended and grounded in goodness don't translate to the real world, ultimately, right? So we were very much a visible family. I was very much a visible kid, one of the only kids of color in a small white community in Rhode Island. And their lack of really training and practice around these things, it was difficult for me in terms of simple things that aren't so simple and do have a huge impact, like what to do with my hair. I was washing my hair every day with Prel and Pert when I needed motions and Carefree Curl and wash day once a week, right? I learned that in my 20s because I didn't know that as a kid. Things like community members looking askance at me, or being treated differently in school, or being called the N-word. I mean, these are all things. And even closer in the family, family members that didn't really have the same principles as my parents did. So all of that was not something my parents were prepared for. Therefore, I was not prepared for. So Did I know I was Black? Yes. Did they ever try to erase that in me, that culture? No. Did they encourage it? No. So I always knew I was Black. I always wanted to be Blacker because I'm biracial. And I always wanted to make it clear to folks that I was indeed Black because I already, at a young age, I already knew that there would be this either or and sometimes a lack of claiming from both white people and Black people. So I understood these things in some ways at a very young age and always knew that I would have to navigate this pretty much as a little soldier by myself. And that's exactly what happened. You know, until more recently when we've all come a little bit, not all of us in the family, but many of us have come to an awakening. And because I do this for a living now, talking very openly about these things, it has really, I think, brought a lot more of these things to the surface for my family in some really transformational and beautiful ways and in some really painful and difficult ways.
Yeah. I certainly, you know, I hear that in your speak and the passion that you're exuding right now, because, you know, in my situation, my second marriage, as you and I talked about during our introductory call, you know, my second wife was Irish and Italian. And then, of course, we had two beautiful daughters. And obviously, you know, I was very proactive in trying to ensure that, you know, the kids did understand growing up. And I can be sympathetic with you because that must have been extremely, extremely hard. Of course, with my wife being Caucasian and like you said, not really knowing what to do with, you know, the kids' hair. And so I had to bring my sister in and, you know, those type of things to kind of balance out the spectrum of making sure that you really have two cultures that you're trying to advance in a single soul, in two human beings that you want to prosper and foster life in the best possible way going forward. And I think one of the other things that brought us together collectively is when we were talking about the fact that I've lived up in that area where you grew up, and certainly, you know, for lack of better terms, just to our listeners, it's just different. You know, you miss that 360 aspect of you know, having diversity and having other relatable things outside of what you perceive to be the norm. But then when you step outside of that box, there are so many other things that you haven't explored that really kind of provide you the fulfillment and tie more closely knitted to your soul. And so as we advance the timeline, April, you go off to college and then you start to step into the roles of some of the great things that you've done. So kind of walk us through when you started to find more discovery as you went to New York. I mean, because when we talked about this in the introductory call, you indicated that, you know, Harlem and those areas, those parts of New York, just kind of brought more, you know, insight, you know, it brought more fulfillment to you. Walk us through some of that.
So leaving home was transformational. I mean, I think for every college bound person, that time is really, really complicated. And for me, because family was so intense for me, I thought that it was the craziest thing you could ever do was to leave your family, like on purpose. I'm like, why would you ever do that? But I was always going to college, so that was so important to me. So I was first, there's that piece of it. On top of it, there was like, okay, so now I got the essence of, oh, I can reinvent myself a little bit. So I didn't write out in college, really wave the flag of, hey, I'm adopted, my parents are white. I kind of let people discover that. And for a while, it felt really good to almost pretend that I had at least one Black parent that had raised me, right? Until Parents Weekend. And then they were like, oh, wait, there's only white people here. Where are you, Black people? So that sort of that trajectory, moving to New York for college outside of New York, had me sort of see the world in a different way, right? And I had Black friends and I had more culture and I was leaning deep into music in high school too, and then college even more so. And then moving to New York City created this duality of, wow, I'm in New York. I'm this little white girl from Rhode Island. Excuse me, a little biracial girl from Rhode Island. Right. See that? And in New York City, right? And I felt this confidence of like, wow, I made it here. And now I was like, but wait, I need more Blackness. Like I need more Black culture. So 17 years of not having that, I quickly navigated New York City and quickly found Harlem, and quickly Harlem became my base, my heart, my soul, all the things that I you know, all the things that I wanted to do, really just for myself ended up being like rooted in Harlem. So that was really an important move for me to have made, to plant myself there.
Right. Right. So you get to Harlem and you start to see the cultural, the heritage, you start to see and absorb more of, you know, let's just say the soulfulness of, you know, what Harlem brings, you know, to just about anybody that goes to Harlem, you know, you just feel that passion of unity and the struggle and the strife that goes on there in Harlem. So how did you begin to get yourself connected and engaged into the community? Because I'm sure, I mean, at least from what I'm gathering here, just through our dialogue, you still kind of felt like you were outside, but yet you were trying to fit yourself into something that you were thirsting for, that you were yearning for, that you were missing. So how did you go about kind of engaging yourself?
Well, you're right. I feel like I needed Harlem, and I really was at first like, do I belong here? And very quickly, I felt this is exactly where I belong. And very quickly, I noticed all that I didn't know about Black culture, right? Mm-hmm. Things that people expected I didn't know because I had never, one, learned them in school, like bits of history, bits of culture, even nuances like the nod. Right. I didn't know from that at all. But then when the first time it happened, I like knew almost like my body and my spirit, my soul, my whole being knew exactly what to do. Right. Mm-hmm. So it became in some ways like my own anthropological, you know, journey in terms of really understanding these bits and then internalizing them. And with every bit I internalized, one, I felt that was for me. And two, I felt that like rush of joy, right. of deep joy. And then, you know, sometimes that was coupled with some anger and some, you know, some confusing thoughts about why did I have to do this on my own? Mm-hmm. Like, why didn't I have that support and guidance? And why wasn't my family sort of gobbling these things up right along with me? Because it was joyous to learn about Black culture. It was beautiful to learn these things and to be embraced by a community. And I thought, well wait, like, why didn't my family do that? So it was both, and it was beautiful and joyous and complicated.
Yeah. I can certainly see that. you know, looking at it from a different lens, or should I say from a reverse lens, just a little side story about me is when I'm involved with my management consultancy firm and I go off to some of these remote areas and we do some of the work that we do, you know, initially, and this is kind of, you know, in a line with what I kind of sense that you felt is, when I show up on some of these facilities after people have talked to me for, let's just say, several weeks as we're trying to get the scope of work and other various things develop, you know, they say to me right out of the gate, my God, we thought you were white. We thought you were somebody different. And when I show up there and I'm thinking like, am I really hearing this? I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of like an out of mind, out of body experience. And you know, I'm wondering if that was kind of relatable to you because, I mean, it seems like you had a lot of fulfillment and things begin to come to fruition. And in my aspect of what I just described, it was almost like a burden that was put on me. It's like, not only do I have to prove my worth, you know, for what we have to do because we were recommended, but now I've got to work twice as hard. I've got to work even, you know, more feverish, you know, in order to satisfy somebody that already has this stigma, this presence about themselves. And so my passion was being able to prove them wrong. And I think from the standpoint of where your passion lied was through discovery. And it was through that discovery of not only, you know, finding out more about, you know, the Black culture, but also the relationship aspect that you were developing with yourself to kind of fulfill that void that you were missing. Is that kind of, you know, in a line with how I'm seeing, you know, your discovery, at least at that stage in your life?
Well, absolutely. I think that the example makes a lot of sense. And as I'm listening to you and kind of tracking back over time, there's a few things that come together with this, right? First is this level of recognizing and being very, very practiced myself in white spaces, right? So going into corporate America, getting high level, you know, management jobs in companies that were mostly white, I knew what to do. I knew how to navigate that. So there's this, on one hand, while there's this high degree of complexity with that, being Black and being in corporate America, being a woman, but I still felt comfortable in that space. I wasn't overly confident, but I was like, I knew what was coming to me, and it had been coming to me my whole life. So I'm like, okay, like, what else do you have? Oh, that I can do that. At the same time, so there's a high degree of confidence in I already know what this whiteness is going to bring to me as a person of color. So it didn't make it, like, you know, any less painful sometimes, but I was like, okay, I know this space. But the part of discovery that was happening in parallel to that was this discovery of Harlem and Black culture. And so on the one hand, I had this corporate life that was very homogenous and very just a lot of work and heavy lifting that I love to do, but also was complicated because you were lifting not just your job, but other things, other dynamics within, you know, that reality. And then in Harlem, it was like, I just was gobbling up so much culture and trying to always find my confidence there. So there's a very interesting parallel realities happening at once, which on some level, when I could step up back, when I could step back from it, was fascinating and interesting and like, wow, like that, I navigated all of that. And then in the moment being, you know, quite frankly, exhausting, like just being completely exhausted by, you know, having to move through white spaces constantly. Even if you were practiced at it, still can be tiring. And then these new discoveries of Black and brown spaces that were so new and beautiful, and yet like trying to just really be clear that I belonged there, you know? So it's very interesting parallels that to be experiencing at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that, you know, like I stated earlier on in our intro call, it was almost like you went down a path that I was very familiar with. And in my professional path, I went down a path that you were very familiar with. And so it was almost like when we were talking and I was taking notes in a very mad way, I was saying to myself, oh my God, I mean, I've got to really figure out a way to kind of bring this storyline into the type of contrast that we're talking about. Because in my case, on the professional side, I ended up being in circumstances where, hey, being the only young Black entrepreneur or professional that's offering this type of skill set in the government space, and then eventually building, you know, for lack of better terms, a small business that actually grew, where people became so focused in on, we've got to have you guys. But yet at every juncture where people didn't know us, you know, there was this whole reset of having to go back to how to deal with those kind of cultural differences. You know, one example would be, you know, to give you an idea, is when we lived in Idaho. You know, I mean, it's rather ironic that people say, well, this just doesn't exist in the U.S. Well, yeah, it does. It's not that we were not accepted there, but when you feel that you're only making up 1% of the population, things do kind of weigh very heavily on you in certain situations. And that's all I have to say about that. I mean, it's just the parallels there, like you said earlier, very similar, but just on opposite ends of the spectrum. And so, April, tell me, with the given situation and kind of how your life is starting to emerge, what are you looking for right now at this juncture? I mean, you've done so many great things. You've experienced a lot. You're coming into your stride. What's the next steps for you?
That's a great question. And right now it feels so unique and not exactly a good way unique, but unique nonetheless in terms of this continued and justified necessary momentum around Black Lives Matter and really this reckoning of the realities of persons of color, Black and brown, in this country. So as someone who, as I've said, feels so practiced in white spaces, my work as a marketer formally in corporate ended several years ago, and I went right, like you had mentioned in the intro, to a nonprofit organization that was around adoption and foster care advocacy and education and research. And even prior to that, I had been doing a second job around mentoring to youth in foster care. So Adopted Adults Mentoring to Youth in Foster Care was a program I started. It's still intact today. So really, even doing the corporate marketing stuff, it wasn't when I was going to pivot to not only nonprofit, but also just being in full service to something that really was about human work, humanitarian work on some level. But not maybe traditionally. So what that looks like for me now is a number of things. When I consult at schools, I make space for young people and children who have the experience of being adopted, and or now we're seeing a lot of kids who are presenting in our groups talking about identity and family structure that were creations by third-party reproduction, either donor egg, donor sperm, surrogacy. So there's some of the same issues about identity and family structure come through in those experiences. So that space, working with parents, working with faculty and staff in schools, doing a lot of work with the federal government on preparing adoptive parents. Some of that block and tackle work that I know so well, right? I'm not a social worker or a mental health care professional, but I have the lived experience and then the thousands of hours of working with families and children. So there's that sort of piece of my work, which is very much about scaffolding, about conditioning and about training, right? If adoption and foster care are Olympic dives of high degrees of difficulty, then we need coaches. We need someone to tell us what to eat, how to do our workouts and stuff. So I think that's part of the role I play there. But I feel now that this work, which has always been rooted also in recognizing the differences of race, class, and culture and the role they play in adoption, foster care, and unique family structures. So now as I look at the both worlds together, right, like my corporate life and my sort of my personal corporate, kind of consulting life, today feels like a time where all that I do in helping many white adoptive parents as they navigate raising a kid that's Black or brown that they're adopting or they have adopted, it's the same work that I would be putting towards a CEO that wants to be in better relationship with the Black or brown people in their corporation. Right. Mm-hmm. So all the personal assessment work that I do with parents, you can't just say, I can love any kid. I don't see color. I mean, that's just dangerous, psychologically and emotionally dangerous for your kid and you. But it's just not reality. What I do is help them really look at what am I eating? What am I internalizing through media? What is my entertainment sort of a diet? What am I watching and listening to and reading? And if that doesn't include a highly diverse menu you are not in service to your own development and your expansion. And then you really can't prove to your kid that you love and care about other Black people other than them or other Black things. If you don't have Black art on your walls, if you're not experiencing Black culture through food, and you don't have Black people in your home that you love and your kid sees you loving, none of that will pass the smell test for your kid, right? And your kid will want to be around white people, will want to do the things you do. So, you know, that on one level, you know, isn't necessarily the worst possible thing that could happen. I don't like that. But where we cross the line into danger is where you're not being clear about the ways in which your kid, your Black or brown kid, has to move in the world to be safe physically, emotionally, and psychologically, that you just don't have to think about. You know, law enforcement, in school, the different things that, you know, kids of color and grownups of color, for that matter, are up against every single day. So there are levels to this. So my role now, I think, or the best way that I can put my passion into practice is to help those who present saying, hey, look, my will is here. I have the will. I don't have the skill. And I'm here to sort of sharpen those skills, to hold people accountable, and to do that in the same way I would my parents, with love, with respect, and with, you know, this idea of holding accountability, but to do that in a way that isn't judgy or finger waggy, or you know, this such a high bar that won't be attainable, because people cannot be paralyzed in this work. They've got to be able to find some movement. So that's what I feel. I mean, and that's hopefully what will come more and more together as time passes.
Yeah. Well, very, very well stated. Very well stated. Well, listen, we're gonna have a little fun now. I just want to have a little fun with you, because, like I said, I've been inspired ever since I've read all of the stuff that's out there about you, all of your great work that you've been doing, not only in foster care and adoption, but race and culture and all the advocacy things that you've been out there doing. I mean, it's been quite impressive. And so what I want to jump into is just a couple, you know, just some fun things, and then we'll kind of wrap up. So these are just going to be 5 quick questions. And what I'd like for you to do is just say what's on your mind, just in a one word or one phrase way. So if you were granted one superpower, what would that be? You still with me, April?
I am.
Well,
I suppose it would be to be even better in relationship to myself. I mean, if that's a superpower, because I do think that's a superpower, like knowing who you are and really leaning and steering directly into that, I think is superhero type stuff. So I'd like to be better at that.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. What is the one favorite quality about yourself?
My strength, physical and emotional, psychological.
All right. All right. Name someone who has inspired you with his or her approach in life.
I would say Toni Morrison, author.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So name one positive change, and I know this one's going to hit home for you, and I saved it to the end. Name one positive change you would love to see in your work life.
Yeah, a pivot back to corporate on my terms, with a real sense of wanting to make change, and knowing that change is possible when the skill is sharpened and people have the will to do this big transformational work.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. There's still much work to be done, even though we've come a long ways. We still have a very long ways to go. And a part of that relates back to acceptance. It relates back to unity and togetherness. And, you know, the whole equality thing is still not at the level where I believe it should be. But hopefully we'll get there. So April, we only have a couple more minutes. Do you have a couple key points you would like to leave with our listeners?
Sure. Well, one, this has been a joy, and you are so very skilled at knitting all of this together in such a way that makes it such an enjoyable podcast. So I thank you for that. It's such a transformational time. I would just say to the listeners, be soft, like be soft to yourself. This is all, we're all doing big work in our own way. And this idea of self-care and caring for others, you know, we can go into the deep water, we can do these big things, and we can still take care of ourselves and buoy others as well. And so that's the big message that I have, because it's when you're in it deep and you're passionate about what you do, and that work is that human work and that big transformational work, it's heavy and it can be really, really hard to see the progress. So, you know, doing a headstand, you know, having a piece of chocolate, you know, you know, taking a nap. I just want to encourage everyone who's doing big work, and I know so many people are, to continue to find softness for yourself.
Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you for those closing takeaways there. That was quite sentimental. And, what I'd like to close out with here is a quote, and I think it's quite relevant considering, as you've stated, you know, if you're out there doing some of the heavy lifting, you really have to consider some of the facts. And, you know, you can't really burn yourself out, because as we all know, this has been a marathon. It's been a marathon for decades, for centuries now, and it will continue to be a marathon that we have to persevere to overcome and to achieve our dreams. So the quote states here, if you feel like there's something out there that you're supposed to be doing, if you have a passion for it, then stop wishing and just do it. And wow, you know, I think that goes very well with our featured guest today, because she is out there doing great things, people. And again, my hat goes off to you, April, and all the great things that you're trying to do. Much love, much respect. We've been honored and delighted to have you on the show and for you to share just a few moments of this time with us. And at least for me personally, I hope this is just the beginning of how we can continue to collectively work together and collaborate and network and do some of this heavy lifting, not just individually, but also as a team. And so with that, this is Gregory Proctor. April, we're going to say goodbye. This is Gregory Proctor, episode 43, Passion and Relationships. Thank you very much, everybody. Be careful, be safe. God bless. Take care. Bye-bye.